confined under pressure, when proper conditions are set up, an explosion results with disastrous effects both from the force of the explosion and the unbalanced released atoms seeking to balance themselves. To date, our scientists in their atomic research have found a use for certain elements, while at the same time establishing vast stockpiles of other elements whose accumulation results in lethal conditions. Since they have so far found no use for this waste, they seal it into huge lead drums and drop them into the sea. But this is not the correct solution to the problem. These pressured elements will continue exerting their energy toward escape, and in time will free themselves to join with other elements for which they have an affinity. The result will be disastrous to life of all variety. On the other hand, scientists on other planets have found means of using the elements which we throw away, by allowing them to unite in certain proportions with other elements, by which they obtain usable energy. In this way they maintain the natural balance of their planets. It may seem difficult for some to understand why people who have progressed so far ahead of us intellectually should continue having accidents. But one must remember that there is always an unknown factor to be taken into consideration. The minerals on their planets are like those on Earth. Scientists, manufacturers, mechanics on Earth who study and work with metals of all kinds, know that conditions sometimes arise in which metals do not react as expected. It has not been too many years that we have been reading about iron metal. Natural conditions set up a variety of effects, many of which can be anticipated, others of which cannot. Even nature herself has a habit of performing in unexpected ways, especially when interfered with by the efforts of men. Man too is an unpredictable product of nature. Thus the effects of his efforts, even when working with other products of nature, will inevitably be subject to faults of one kind or another which may result in minor or major accidents. The wise man learns from all such experiences and through continuous effort progresses along the pathway of life, wherever he may be living. With so many of their ships moving through our atmosphere, permitting close observation of Earth's people and their ways, it did not take long for the space travelers to learn of the many divisions and misunderstandings existing in our world. Their history showed the fallacy of such conditions, and the inevitable results such as we are experiencing today. The cosmic plan is for a united people on each planet. Although their original purpose in coming was to answer what they thought was a signal for help from us, and to alert us if necessary to natural changes taking place in our solar system, they also turned their efforts toward helping us broaden our concepts of human relations, that we might halt our headlong race toward nuclear destruction. From this closer association with Earthlings, they were surprised to find how really little accurate understanding we had of ourselves, let alone of the atmosphere surrounding our planet, practically nothing of the ionosphere, our protective electromagnetic shield, and its purpose with no true knowledge whatever of the cosmos of which we are a part. They sent increasing numbers of their ships, both large and small, to cruise through our atmosphere in the hope that people's curiosity would be stimulated towards seeking greater understanding of what was taking place, and of the ownership of these strange craft. More and more of their people landed to live among us in the hope that, through their presence, we would be influenced by their kindness, their lack of criticism of others, and their willingness to be friends with all. Furthermore, through casual conversations they could awaken sleeping minds to a vaster concept of life and the cosmos. Even then they did not realize for a while the many fears that the presence of their ships in our skies would create. Nor were they able to conceive the depth to which such fears would incite us, that official orders would be issued for them to be shot down. As a result, some of their ships were destroyed and the crewmen killed. In spite of their understanding of life and its continuance, they did not appreciate such acts on our part. It did not take them long to learn to stay beyond the range of our ships and their attack abilities, although coming near enough for close observation through their technical instruments. They were also able at times to increase the repulsive power within their force fields, thus repelling the smaller of our bullets. In this way they lessened the danger to themselves, while still being able to continue the work for which they came. 2. space activity within our solar system. One of the most frequent problems encountered when giving a lecture on space is the insistence of scientists that the outer planets are devoid of light and heat. Their objection is that radiation from the Sun is so weak at these vast distances that Pluto, for instance, would be at absolute zero or close to it, with a frozen atmosphere, and totally incapable of supporting life forms of any type. This is the main argument brought against me when doubt is expressed about my meeting human beings from some of these other planets. The first thing to realize is that the Sun does not emit light and heat in the form we observe here on Earth. Radiation from the Sun does not manifest itself as light and heat until it penetrates the atmospheres of the planets themselves. Outer space is devoid of light as we know it. The light in outer space is a cold light caused by the phosphorescence of vast clouds of particles and gases responding to the radiation given off by the Sun. To a human observer, outer space looks like a dark, vast void, filled with billions upon billions of tiny specks of multicolored light. All of these tiny lights are in a state of continuous motion and activity. Radiation from the Sun is composed of ultraviolet light, hard and soft X-rays, cosmic and gamma rays. The greater portion of these destructive rays are filtered out by a planet's ionosphere and upper atmosphere. The innumerable, infinitesimal particles within a planet's atmosphere emit visible light when excited by the Sun's filtered radiation. The Earth absorbs these rays, and in return gives off infrared energy. Energy thus given off activates the atmosphere immediately surrounding the planet, thereby generating heat that keeps the planet warm. It is easy to see how this energy from the Sun can encompass our Earth. After all, we are only 93 million miles from the Sun. But what about the planets that are more remote from the Sun? According to standard textbooks, the radiation from the Sun decreases inversely with the square of the distance. In layman's language, this means that if you double the distance from the Sun, the radiation would be only one-fourth as great. If you double the distance again, the radiation would be only one-sixteenth as great, and so on. If the Sun's radiation actually decreases at this rate, then the outer planets must indeed be in a state of perpetual coldness. What, then, is the answer? I know from personal experience that these outer planets have thriving civilizations, with climates and atmospheres similar to our own Earth. The larger planets, such as Saturn and Jupiter, have much lower gravity than has been assumed by our scientists. Therefore, our explanation of gravity must be an error in some way. Our main problem now is not gravity but climate. How do these planets receive enough energy from the Sun to exist in a similar state to Earth? A clue to this answer is found in the vacuum tube, more specifically it is found in the cathode ray tube. This tube, abbreviated CRT, is found in the ordinary home television receiver. In it we have a heater that raises the temperature of a cathode to a point at which it gives off electrons in great quantities. These electrons are negative in nature. High positive voltages are supplied to various grids and anodes in the tube. There are two types of electricity, positive and negative. The electron is negative in its counterpart. The proton is positive. Just as the north pole of a magnet will attract the south pole of another magnet, the electrons attract the protons. Similar poles of magnets repel each other and so do similar charges of electricity. Likes repel, unlikes attract. The high positive voltages on the grids and anodes of the CRT attract the electrons from the cathode. The electrons are pulled toward the anodes with great speed, but, due to the type of construction of these anodes, most electrons rush right on through toward the next one. Theoretically, this could be continued for great distances by use of several different anodes and high positive voltages. Mercury, Venus, Earth and Mars are close enough to the Sun to get good radiation. With the planets beyond Mars it is a different situation. At these distances the Sun's radiation has started to diminish. At this time it comes under the influence of the tremendous attractant force generated by the first asteroid belt which totally envelopes the central portion of our solar system. The negative charge of the asteroid belt is great enough to attract the particles from the Sun and pull them back up to their original speed. because this belt is grid-like in construction, with thousands of openings and paths, similar to a Windows screen with air going through. The particles dash on through and enter the influence of the planets beyond. These, being negative in themselves, as are all planets, attract from space the positive particles they need for light and heat. At the same time, infinite numbers of similar particles rush on past and are attracted by a second asteroid belt between Neptune and Pluto, where the process is repeated all over again. This furnishes Pluto and the last three planets with normal light and heat. 12 planets in all exist in our system, according to the space travelers. A third asteroid belt is beyond the 12th planet, serving a dual purpose of blending space within our system with that of neighboring systems. At the same time, it serves as a protective filter, comparable to the ionosphere encompassing a planet. We might summarize by saying, the two inner asteroid belts gather rays from the Sun and speed them on through space. They equalize, so to speak, conditions within the system from the area of Mercury right on to the outer reaches of our solar system, while the third keeps our system, as a unit, in balance with those beyond. Because of this cosmic activity, of which we on Earth have not previously been aware, we could go to any of our planets and enjoy a climate and atmosphere similar to our own. With the asteroid belt, basically negative in nature, attracting sun rays varying in length, speed, width, and charge, a condition is set into action comparable to an alternating current in electricity. Some of the positive particles are trapped within the asteroid belt, while others zip right on through to radiate through space beyond. The law of attraction and repulsion permits a state of cohesion to take place between some of the particles within the belt, building larger forms, while a major percentage remain in their natural state. Particles of many sizes thus created are caused to constantly act upon one another in energy and the matter alike. This very action, while building some forms, also disintegrates other forms by separating the particles of which they are composed. Serving as nature's dielectric in this manner, the asteroid belt, I have been told, is the womb of the cosmos out of which planets are born. When a planet reaches its peak of service in a system and starts on the path of decline and disintegration, a body is drawn from the asteroid belt by the magnetic influence of that planet's orbit to maintain the perfect balance of the system. So, as the old planet disintegrates, a new one is built to replace it. On a larger scale, systems go through the same cycle of birth, growth and extinction and follow the pattern as do all forms in nature. In using the term extinction, I am referring to matter going back into the gaseous or invisible state. It is not destroyed, it is only changed in form. A good example of this is seen when ice becomes water and finally evaporates into vapor. After matter has returned to its original or gaseous state, it is free to start the cycle all over again. It may travel across interplanetary distances and become part of another planet, or it may return to become a part of its original planet, serving in the construction of new forms. With this continuous interchange between the planets, it is only natural to find each planet has similar materials in its makeup and similar plant and animal life on its surface. With a few exceptions. Billions of giant Milky Way systems or galaxies, like our own, are known to exist throughout the vast reaches of the never-ending cosmos. Toward the center of these giant systems so far observed by our telescopes are found the newer and hotter stars. As the galaxy expands outward, these stars cool and planetary systems are born. In these cooler outer edges are billions of life-supporting planets. Here also are vast clouds of oxygen and hydrogen spreading out over thousands of light-years of distance. This is readily apparent from examination of recent color photographs taken with the 200-inch telescope at Mount Palomar, made with a newly developed supercolor film. These photographs show great bluish clouds of oxygen, and the reddish clouds of hydrogen existing throughout about 65% of most observable galaxies. The only area where these gases are not apparent is in the hot nucleus of the galaxy itself. In our own solar system, our Sun is only one of a group of some 100,000 million stars. Several hundred thousand inhabited planets could easily be in existence in our Milky Way solar system alone. Imagine if you can this pattern of suns and their associated planets multiplied billions of times, extending without beginning or end. Man and his ego has said that our Earth is the center of this vast array. He has refused to consider the possibility of our planet not being unique in the cosmos. Now he is being forcibly awakened first by friendly visits from our neighbors, whose interplanetary ships have been seen moving through our atmosphere and over every nation in our world, and now by our own space explorations. All of these wonders are awaiting us as we slowly measure our way step by step into outer space, of which we know so little. Already many ancient but accepted theories have been cast aside. As the cosmos lies before us, understanding extends unlimited to the seeking mind, as did new lands to our pioneers of old. They were the pioneers of Earth. Today we are pioneers of space with its ceaseless activity and endless wonders. Worlds upon worlds. Expressions of the one infinite creator. 3. Spaceships and gravity. As the Earthman plans voyages into outer space, he is faced to a certain degree with problems comparable in many ways to those of the ancient mariner, for throughout space there are definite natural lanes, just as the oceans have their currents. Our pilots have found rivers in space above our planet as they were flying at certain altitudes. These were located by chance, but since have been described in numerous articles published in aviation magazines. Our scientists and our airmen are aware of various types of currents moving through the atmosphere, comparable to those of the oceans. We will find similar conditions throughout all space, between planets and systems. As they studied such conditions in the atmospheres encompassing their own planets, inhabitants of other worlds were able to develop their first ships, enabling them to venture into outer space. Since that time, space has become as safe and simple for them to travel as the atmosphere through which our planes fly from place to place on Earth. They quickly realized that if they were to go out and return safely home, they could not burden their ships with heavy loads of fuel, but would have to learn how to use nature's energy for their propulsion power. So it was along these lines that their scientists worked, and finally succeeded. To understand more clearly the magnetic propulsion of interplanetary spacecraft, we must first consider geomagnetism, the magnetic sphere of influence which surrounds every planet and every sun, filling all space. We can liken Earth's geomagnetic field to the series of circular ripples created by dropping a pebble into a pond. These circular ripples move outward from the center point where the pebble was dropped, expanding in size, but diminishing in force as they move. If we simultaneously drop two pebbles into the pond, several feet apart, two sets of expanding circular waves are created, moving outward from each central point. Where the wave fronts meet, an interference pattern is formed which extends between the two center points. This interference pattern assumes the shape of an extended ellipse, with its smaller ends at the points where the pebbles were dropped. Although both wave fronts have diminished in force as they traveled outward from their central points, the interference pattern has combined a portion of both forces to create a third force, which remains constant between the two central points so long as they remain active. The same relationship exists between the expanding spheres of magnetic influence which move into space from the Sun, and from each planet or satellite. As these magnetic wave fronts expand from another source, they form a magnetic interference pattern which again assumes the general shape of an extended ellipse. Although the geomagnetic field of each planet or sun diminishes in strength as it moves spaceward, the elliptical magnetic fields thus created between celestial bodies by magnetic interferences maintain a constant strength magnetic field between the bodies. A planet's magnetic field is similar to direct current, which grows weaker as it travels from its source. However, the elliptical magnetic field shared by two planets may be likened to alternating current, which can be transmitted over long distances. These alternating elliptical fields, extending from sun to planet, and from planet to planet, are the invisible bonds which balance the solar system. They extend in similar fashion between systems, and between galaxies. They also exist between the micromagnetic fields of atoms, the miniature solar systems. The end zones of elliptical fields which influence Earth extend from about 58 degrees north latitude to 58 degrees south latitude. The axis of each elliptical field is at right angles to the magnetic polar axis, and the elliptical field axis corresponds to Earth's magnetic equator. The magnetic rivers between planets constantly alternate or change their direction of flow, creating a two-way magnetic pulse between planets. By using only one half of each two-way pulse, space liners move in one direction. For example, if the spacecraft uses only an outward pulse, it moves away from a planet. If the ship uses an inward pulse, it moves toward a planet. If the spacecraft allows the alternating pulse to flow through it in both directions, it can hover. To explain how the spaceships operate within a planet's gravitational field, we must first recognize the relationship between geomagnetism and the planet's rotation. On Earth, many writers have referred to anti-gravity devices, and in our scientific researches the idea has been introduced that gravity can be wrestled to a standstill. This is not an efficient approach. Spaceships that today are visiting our world from other planets operate on a progravitic principle, using dinatural forces, instead of attempting to fight them. Since these ships operate on electrostatic power, it would be useless for them to fight the geomagnetic forces, since Earth's geomagnetic field alone has an electrical potential of billions of volts. Planetary gravity is the natural balance between the centrifugal force of a planet's axial velocity and the centripetal attraction of its electrostatic field. Centrifugal force tries to spin an object from the planet's surface, but electrostatic attraction keeps the object from flying into space. If electrostatic attraction did not exist, we would have to hang firmly to a tree or rock to keep from being hurled into space by centrifugal force. By the same token, if centrifugal force did not exist to balance electrostatic attraction and its inward centripetal force, we would be flattened against the Earth's surface. I believe the late Dr. Albert Einstein described this balanced, inseparable relationship in his unified field theory. However, my observations are not so profound as those achieved by that great abstract scientist. We have briefly challenged the gravitational force with our aircraft and rockets. Now it is time to consider the benefits we can derive from putting that force to work for us. A rocket is pushed forward by a concentrated chemical thrust that is greater than the pull of gravity. The ionic rockets we are now planning will expel ions out of their engines and achieve thrust exactly like the chemical rockets. Ionic rockets, however, cannot operate efficiently within the unified field of a planet. They are only efficient in the near vacuum of outer space. A flying saucer, or progravitic craft, operates by generating its own gravitational field, which surrounds it in a generally spherical pattern. This field is adjusted to resonate, or blend in harmony with the planet's geomagnetic field. The resonating gravitational field causes the ship to be weightless. In this weightless or balanced condition, the ship, wherever it may be, can be moved by a relatively slight thrust. Our ionic rockets are designed to exert the electrical thrust of ionized particles, a thrust so relatively small it has been termed slight as a butterfly's sigh. In outer space, however, where the ionic rocket would be weightless, because it would be free of planetary gravity, this tiny sigh of ionic power could propel the rocket at speeds eventually reaching 3 million miles per hour, according to present theory. Within its self-generated progravitic field, the saucer can travel at a rate exceeding the speed of light. Using the forces of nature, its movement can be the same as that of natural forces. The propelling power as produced by the generator within the spacecraft can be compared to that provided by the Van de Graaff electrostatic generators which are used in our own physics laboratories. An interesting laboratory demonstration which simulates the effect of a hovering saucer can be achieved by placing an aluminum ring over the vertical core of a large electromagnet. By passing an alternating current through the electromagnet, controlled with a rheostat, the aluminum ring can be made to hover. The saucers, however, generate their own resonating fields, instead of floating on magnetic eddy currents as in the case of the aluminum ring. Electrostatic thrust can be demonstrated by placing a tiny strip of aluminum foil near the discharge globe of a Van de Graaff generator. The foil will orbit the discharge globe, with no mechanical connection. Sources have often been described as glowing. Such a condition is created when natural particles in space, through which a ship is moving, come into contact with its encompassing field of resonant frequency. Pulsations within this field cause a shimmering effect, like heat waves rising from pavement, which makes the craft appear to be alive and breathing. This effort can also bend the light waves entirely around the craft, causing it to suddenly disappear from view, though it is actually still there, and not dematerialized, as some individuals would have one believe. There is also another explanation of these sudden disappearances. As the field strength is varied, ionization may shift through every color of the spectrum. Increased energy causes the field to shift up past the visible portion of the spectrum, obscuring the craft from view, the same as a heavy cloud bank obscures a plane. The intense resonating field also serves as a shield to deflect space debris from the ship. At the same time, a blend is automatically set up between this field and atmosphere or space through which a spacecraft may be moving, thus preventing friction of any kind. Because of this progravitic nature in its operation, occupants of a spaceship are not affected by any violent maneuver or uncomfortable atmospheric conditions. To travel at speeds faster than light, the ship's field is tuned to a higher resonant point and the craft achieves prime merge. For this, the ship is equipped with an automatic robot detector and control system, designed with provisions for manual control. Contrary to accepted theories, matter is not converted to pure energy under such conditions. A ship within its force field can be compared to a planet within its atmosphere, moving as a unit through space. So, when a spaceship accelerates and seems to disappear, it has merely achieved prime merge and its force field is vibrating at a speed faster than visible light. At higher frequencies, it may become transparent to radar signals also. The whole effect seen in many saucer photos is created by a magnetic window. One small portion of the ship's force field is neutralized, permitting visual and radar-type observation. At times, this is necessary when the force field of the craft is at a fairly high resonance. The three-ball undercarriage seen on most saucers serves both as a retractable landing gear and as a three-point electrostatic propulsion control system. The mother ships use a series of bands built into the framework for the same control purpose. As we use retro rockets to steer a rocket vehicle, the saucers use their variable three-point systems to maneuver by regulating the charge. In horizontal flight within a planet's ionosphere, saucers travel along the planet's geomagnetic lines of force. They turn abruptly by shifting the ball charge. In this way, they are guided into and utilize the eddy currents found throughout space. A change of direction in the movement of a spacecraft may appear as a sudden 90-degree turn, or any of the erratic maneuvers so often ascribed to the saucers. One important factor that our engineers for spacecraft will have to take into consideration is the multiple wall construction required for safety purposes, as well as storage room for a large percentage of their propulsion equipment. There must be a minimum of two charged walls. The outer, negative wall comes in direct contact with the protective force field created around the ship. By its very nature, this electrostatic force field ionizes all particles of matter near the ship's surface, and negatively charges space debris coming within its field of influence. The greater the amount of power used, the farther this influence extends from the ship. A positive reference field is established in an inner wall, leaving the central portion of the ship at a neutral potential. Important too is an automatic filtering and air conditioning system installed between walls of a ship to purify the air and keep temperatures and pressures within the craft at a comfortable state for all persons aboard. Actually, there is not too much difference between modern spacecraft and our own submarines that can surface on the water where outside pressures are light, or go to great depths where pressures against the ship are intense. At any depth, the submarine can maneuver at will, without harm or discomfort to its occupants. So it is with a spaceship. In outer space, the pressures against it are light. When it enters a planet's ionosphere and approaches the planet, pressures intensify. Yet, wherever it is, It can maneuver at will without harm or discomfort to its occupants. As our submarine navigators have had to become acquainted with the many rivers flowing beneath the surface of the ocean, so our space navigators will have to learn the magnetic lanes of outer space, as well as those between a planet and its ionosphere. Temperatures, flow and currents throughout the cosmos vary continually, in repeated patterns.